Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon. Candice Bergen grew up in Hollywood, the daughter of a world-famous ventriloquist. She's appeared in numerous movies, including The Sand Pebbles, Carnal Knowledge, Starting Over, and Miss Congeniality. On television, she made headlines as the tough-talking journalist Murphy Brown, for which she won 5 Emmys. She later starred in the TV series Boston Legal. Her most recent Broadway appearances include Gore Vidal's The Best Man and A.R. Gurney's Love Letters. In 1984, she wrote the best-selling memoir, Knock Wood, covering the life, her life up to that point. And now she's written a follow-up memoir, A Fine Romance, which is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm very pleased to welcome Candice Bergen to our show today.
Welcome back. Nice to see you again.
Whom does the Fine Romance of your title refer to? Not Fred Astaire.
But he certainly was the inspiration. It primarily refers to the love that I found for my daughter the second she was born. It's about the love between my late husband and myself, and then the surprise relationship with my current husband. But it's primarily the love between a mom and a daughter.
Do you take pride in the fact that you had what you refer to as a weird upbringing?
I'm so proud of that, because nobody has had a childhood like mine, and I just love it.
To start with, you were known for many years as Charlie McCarthy's younger sister, and you didn't love it for a long time.
No, I didn't.
How did because you were playing second fiddle to a puppet?
Well, you see, in my house, he was no mere puppet. My father had to fight with him to get first billing. It was known as the Charlie McCarthy Show with Edgar Bergen. And Charlie in our household was really like a major head of state.
And is it true that your father would put Charlie on one knee and then you on his other knee and get a conversation going?
Yes. I mean, this was not when I was in my 20s. Breakfast table when I was maybe 5 or 6. And he would put me on one knee and Charlie on the other. And when he would squeeze the back of my neck, that was my signal to move my mouth. And he would provide the voices for both Charlie
for both of you.
Yes.
So you weren't even able to voice your own opinions on these things. But you were part of a comedy act.
Yes, a very quiet, private comedy act.
It would be hard not to have a sibling rivalry, since Charlie had his own bedroom next to yours and his was bigger.
It's true.
Did you ever ask your parents if you could switch rooms with him? And what happened to Mortimer? Did he get short shrift, Mortimer Snurd?
Mortimer did not have residential privileges. Mortimer lived in a trunk at the office.
But you still got the smaller bedroom. What was in Charlie's bedroom that where he needed one so big?
Well, he had his own dresser with his own clothes. I do hasten to add that my room was a corner room, however, though it was a modest room. And Charlie had his own little desk at the office, a little blonde pine wood modernist desk with Charlie McCarthy on the nameplate. He had a very definite presence.
And that's kind of surreal, growing up in a surreal situation.
Well, when you grow up in it, you don't know that it's surreal.
Did you know in advance that Charlie would get a bequest in your father's will when he died, while you didn't even get mentioned?
No, that was a surprise.
What do you think he was thinking?
You know, my father was not an irrational man. My father was as grounded and as unpretentious as anyone I've ever met.
And incredibly funny.
He was very funny, but he was also Swedish, so he was sometimes funny, and sometimes he was just very quiet and introverted. And what my father was when he had a section in the will devoted to Charlie, it was recognizing the impact of this character that he created on his life and on mine, I might add.
Well, you didn't need the money, but it still hurts, I think, I'm sure. Your only brother, Chris, is 15 years younger than you.
Yes.
Was he left anything?
He was.
Was his upbringing different from yours? Had the family dynamic changed?
Well, my brother said we would call each other pal. And he said, you know, pal, when you were growing up, Charlie had his own room. When I was growing up, he lived in a trunk in the hall. So my father's career was in its descendants. And and so, yes, Charlie was no longer the life force of the house.
Some years ago, we had the man behind Elmo who came on our show, and he had a suitcase with him. And my producer said, you can leave the suitcase in the ready room. He said, I cannot. That's Elmo.
Yeah.
So, and he was responding to him as though he was a real person.
Well, Leonard, this should not surprise you. And I have heard many. I remember a friend of mine was on a ship with a famous puppeteer called Bert Clampett, who created the character Beulah, who was a witch. Mm-hmm. And she was on television, and I loved Beulah. And my friend came into his stateroom one evening and opened the door, and he was in bed with Beulah next to him in bed. And she said, my God, you sleep with Beulah? He said, I always sleep with Beulah.
Hmm. Well,
it's a very delicate, complicated dance.
Let's get back to your memoir. Your first memoir, Knock Wood, concentrated on your childhood and your life as a young adult. And this book starts with the birth of your daughter and then flashes back to your marriage to Louis Malle, the celebrated French movie director. Do you see the two memoirs as continuous, or was there a real break in your life at one point?
Well, there was not a break in my life. I mean, my husband died in 1995.
Very young, actually.
Very young.
62, was he?
63. Hmm. And he had just turned 63. And then I did Murphy Brown for 3 or 4 more years.
Had you been tempted to marry before you met Louis?
No, I'd been asked, but I never came close, really.
And he died young, but he was the director of many well-received films in the United States and France, including Elevated to the Gallows with that famous score by Miles Davis.
Yeah.
The Lovers, which played an important role in U.S. censorship history. It went to the Supreme Court. My Dinner with Andre, Pretty Baby, Atlantic City, Comme Lucien, Au revoir les enfants, Vanya on 42nd Street. Did you ever discuss working together on a project?
We discussed it, but we thought, first of all, I don't think I could have been an actor in Louis' movies. I was not capable of that kind of subtlety in my acting. But but we talked about it, but he thought, he just said, it's difficult enough directing actors, but then coming home and not being able to escape them is just asking too much. And of course, he was right.
You write that you consider Louis an artist while your career dealt strictly in commerce, but can't carnal knowledge, Gandhi, and starting over be considered art?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But I mean, I'm not being overly self-effacive, but really what I contributed to those movies was rather modest.
You did have many shared interests, but there were a few major differences between the two of you. You were raised in California luxury, and he was raised in a magnificent medieval chateau in the southwest of France.
No, he was not raised there. That's the house that he bought, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, but he was raised in Lille in France. His family were they made beet sugar. They were one of the two from the Napoleonic era. They were one of the two prime sugar manufacturers.
So he didn't grow up poor?
No, not at all.
When you took down a row of 15-foot hedges around the pool in France because it felt claustrophobic, Louis told you, this is not Bel Air.
Yes, but I could try. The house in the southwest of France is a very beautiful house. It's from the 15th century onward. It's not a suburban tract house. It has great roots and great character and sort of mystery, but it tended to austere. Mm-hmm. So I just opened it up a little bit.
And were you ever able to reconcile the differences?
Well, I mean,
in style, I'm talking about.
Actually, our apartments were very similar in taste. So Louis moved into my apartment, and his Indian tankas just went very well with all of my Indian sculptures, and his carpets worked with my Persian carpets. So in many ways, our taste was similar.
I'm talking with Candace Bergen, who has written a second memoir, this one, A Fine Romance. It is published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Talking of India, shortly after your marriage, you got the opportunity to perform in the movie Gandhi, playing the great photographer Margaret Bourke White. Hadn't Louis gotten into trouble with the Indian government for a documentary he'd made years before?
Oh, he had been banned from ever entering India, and I believe the ban had just been lifted, and it was his first time back in the country. He made a 9-hour documentary on India that he and two other crew members, he did his own camera work, and he did the wrote and did the narration, and it
was an award-winning documentary.
It was award-winning, and it was shown on BBC and in America, and India was offended because he had shown poverty in India, which is frankly very hard to avoid if you're in the country. And so when he arrived to visit me in India, on the front page of the Bombay Daily or the Herald, there was a tiny headline that said, Louis Malle is back in town, which he loved, of course.
But India was often called the world's greatest democracy. It's kind of shocking that they would have banned him from making a movie, although more recently wasn't the BBC that got into trouble for talking with a rapist in his jail cell?
In India? The BBC was kicked out of India after they ran Louis' movie called Phantom India. So it's not the first time the BBC has gotten in trouble in India.
When he joined you, did he take you to places that you might not have gone to otherwise?
Well, we were in Bombay at the same time as one of my oldest friends, Mary Ellen Mark, who's one of our greatest photographers, and she had managed to gain access to an area in Bombay where the Cage Girls worked and lived, and it was former stables that were made into sort of pods, which is stables for where women would work as prostitutes, and they were women as young as 10, 11, 12, and it was a taste of poverty that I never hope to have again.
It's good that you didn't make a film about it. You would have been banned from India.
That's true.
But she's gone back many times, Mary Ellen Mark.
She goes to India like people go to the Caribbean. For her, it's a vacation. She loves India. She knows it unlike almost any other person. And she was friendly with all of the Cage Girl madams, and she would go back and forth. She'd bring them Tylenol and wigs and nightgowns. I mean, they were so thrilled to see her.
Did you and Louis hesitate before deciding to have a child?
Oh, well, we didn't for almost 5 years.
Well, he had children.
He has two children.
And did that bother you that he maintained such close relations with the mothers of his two kids?
Well, it bothered me in the sense that they were freely coming to the house to stay while we were there. And so that was a slight bump in the road. But we got over it, and his kids are just wonderful kids that I love them very much.
One of them was Alexandra Stewart, who's a pretty great actress, an American who's made a career in France. Oh, but she's made a real career in France.
She's spent her life in France.
Did the baby, who's now your adult daughter, Chloe, change your priorities?
Oh, yeah.
Well, some people just continue going on with their careers. You stopped for a while?
I stopped working for 3 years, and then I was getting a little crazy, and so I would do occasionally a week someplace, and then when she was 4 and a half, I got the offer to do Murphy, and it seemed like the only way to combine working with knowing where one would be past, say, the next week.
Murphy allowed you to do comedy.
Yes, very much
so. You were absolutely great in comedy, but you hadn't done much comedy before. Why do you think that was?
I think I had a certain coolness to my looks that people thought would never. I mean, they just didn't think humor would be possible in someone who looked like me. But in fact, it was where I was at my most comfortable.
Your looks really have played a role in your life. In fact, didn't Warren Beatty once talk to you about that?
Well,
how they determine your life in some ways?
I did a movie that Warren wrote and directed and produced and stars in. I don't even know the name of the movie, but it's about Howard Hughes, because I never saw a script. I knew nothing. I was just on set for a few days. But Warren, who I'd known for 50 years, said, we were talking about the old days and beauty, and he said, you know, he said, it opens any door. He said, it gives you a backstage pass.
And it led you into a modeling career for a time.
I modeled during summers when I was in college, so it wasn't really a full-fledged modeling career.
I understand that Warren Beatty's still working on that film.
I don't know that he'll ever stop.
Well, you have to wonder why. He's had successes in the past. It's not like Orson Welles, who made great movies but never could get any financing.
Yes, there are differing stories on Orson and financing, but it was wonderful to be on the set with Warren because he's clearly in control and has great gifts.
My guest is Candace Bergen, who has written a memoir, her second memoir. This one's called A Fine Romance. It is published by Simon & Schuster, and we will take a little break and come back with more. This month, the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club is reading Karl Ove Knausgård's six-part autobiographical novel, My Struggle. Book 4 of My Struggle lands in the United States on April 28th, but Karl Ove will be discussing the entire series with us on May 8th. Submit your questions for him on our show page at WNYC.org, and keep up with all of our book club news by subscribing to our newsletter at WNYC.org/bookclub. You're listening to WNYC, WNYC.org. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, where our handle is @LeonardLopate.
WNYC support comes from Jazz at Lincoln Center, presenting vocalists Andy Bay, Molly Johnson, and Sarah Elizabeth Charles as part of the Billie Holiday Festival, April 10th and 11th at Jazz at Lincoln Center, Columbus Circle. Tickets at jalc.org. New York Presbyterian Hospital, working to bring advanced and compassionate care to the New York City community. More information available at nyp.org/amazingthings. New York Presbyterian, amazing things are happening here. Join New York Public Radio's Community Advisory Board and help determine how to meet the needs of WNYC, WQXR, and New Jersey Public Radio listeners. Apply by Monday, April 20th. Details at 646-829-4000 or wnyc.org/cab.
Whether it's on your commute, during your workout, or while you fold the laundry, the WNYC app makes your daily routine, well, less routine. Get caught up in fascinating stories on shows like Fresh Air, 99% Invisible, and The Takeaway. You can listen live or create a custom playlist with the Discover feature. You can even listen on the subway. Perk up your routine anytime with the WNYC app.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of Joe Carr and Tamale Tsarnaev. Terry Gross talks with journalist Masha Gessen about her new book, which traces the backstory of the two brothers from their family's experiences as exiles and immigrants to the brothers' radicalization. That's today at 2 on 93.9 FM. And we're back with Candace Bergen. She's written a second memoir, a follow-up to her bestseller, Knock Wood. This one, A Fine Romance, published by Simon & Schuster. The when you received the first script for Murphy Brown, did you find it something that you thought you really wanted to do?
I thought it was as if it were written for me. I wanted to do it so badly. I just thought the writing was of a level and a wit, and it reminded me of the great comedies of the 40s. It was so fast and smart and sassy. I was just what I would have been crushed if I hadn't had the chance to do it.
And then the network wanted Diane English, its creator, to adjust the character.
Yes. Well, first of all, they wanted her to adjust it so that it was not cast with me. They wanted Heather Locklear to star in it, and they wanted Murphy. Murphy and the pilot came off the elevator, and she had just spent a month for alcoholism being treated at Betty Ford. And they said, well, does she have to come back after a month at Betty Ford? Couldn't she just come back after a weekend at a spa? Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to defang Murphy, which, of course, the whole point of Murphy was that she had teeth.
Mm-hmm. And actually, we see a lot more of that kind of comedy today. I suspect Murphy Brown is one of the reasons, the success of it is one of the reasons comedies have gotten tougher today, and we have main characters who have flaws.
Yes, Murphy was never mean, but certainly she was relentless, and she would back down for no one, and could be very pesty. But my mission was always to have Murphy redeemed by the end of each episode.
You were nominated for an Academy Award for Starting Over with Burt Reynolds, where you had a chance to sing. And there's a famous scene in Murphy Brown where you sing Respect.
Oh, well, I sang a few times in Murphy Brown. It just would be still my heart. I was so happy.
Your mother had sung.
My mother was, in fact, an excellent singer and had made an album. But one of the times I sang on Murphy, I was sitting next to Aretha Franklin on the piano bench singing Natural Woman. And that was as scared as I've ever been, basically.
Well, did you think you sang well?
Of course I didn't. The whole point was that I was a horrible singer. But there was such a joy in not only admitting to that, but to sort of flaunting it.
I've heard people try to sing off key, and you can always tell. But the people who really can't sing in key, you know right away that's just naturals.
That would be me.
How did you balance the routine of filming a weekly series with taking care of a kid?
Well, on a half-hour show, you have a week off a month, and you get to work at 9:30 or 10 in the morning, so I could take my daughter to preschool, and then subsequently I could do carpool in the mornings, and I could be home by 5 and have supper with her and, you know, be with her when she had her bath. And then I would have a week off a month where I could be at school and serve lunches and do parent functions, which is a large part of the reason that I wanted to do Murphy, because when you have a child over a certain age, you want to know where you're going to be and to have a predictability.
What about its effect on your marriage? These days it probably would have been shot in New York, but then it was L.A., and Louis was spending a lot of his time here and in France.
It was very hard on our marriage. That's where life got messy.
Why do you think suddenly New York is where so many of these shows are being filmed?
Well, I think that Mayor Bloomberg was very accommodating in terms of tax incentives that he created because before that nobody could even think of shooting in New York. It was just prohibitive.
And now you have a show like The Good Wife taking place in Chicago. It's yeah. obviously in Greenpoint. You have The Americans in Washington. It's shot in Greenpoint. Then you have some shows like Girls that are meant to be seen as being shot yeah. in Greenpoint. But it's really
tying up traffic wherever you go. But it's great.
You write that, like many women at the time, you wanted to be Murphy Brown. What did you admire about the character?
Oh, I think because of the era that I grew up in, I loved that she didn't care what people thought of her. I loved that she knew what she wanted, that she went after it, that she was as good as any man in her field, which was a field of television journalism, which until then had been fairly closed to women, and that she had a brashness and a confidence, that she was bratty. I thought that was just really fun to play.
And that she, wasn't like you in real life?
Well, I can be very bratty, but...
I didn't mean the bratty
but
part,
only,
I just
but
meant...
No, but only when I'm with my friends.
Uh-huh.
I loved that she had a sense of self that was without boundaries.
It was a critical and commercial hit. You won 5 Emmy Awards, the most for one person playing the same role. But you also say that that it was important for you to always keep her from being too abrasive, to keep her human.
Yeah.
And was that something that you did as an actor, or was that also in the script? Did you insist on script changes?
Yeah. I mean, in television, obviously, the writer is the master, but I would have arguments often about Murphy, and the just lifting her, redeeming her by the end of each episode so that she was not just an unbearable shrew. Really, it was a fine line.
When she became a mother in 1992, did anyone anticipate the repercussions?
Ha! Huh. Certainly not. Who could have thought? I mean, who could have even envisioned such a thing?
I'm sure that in retrospect, Vice President Dan Quayle's famous speech about Murphy Brown was actually a great boost for the show. It gave you all sorts of publicity that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
Oh, it made us number one, number two show for a couple of months. We owe him everything, in fact.
The Hollywood community often made fun of Quayle for his misstatements and his misspellings, as well as for some of his policies. Do you think he was trying to get even?
He would have been entitled. I mean, he certainly, but he also should have known that you don't take on television writers without paying a price. But, I mean, he was, in fact, quite savvy. The remark about Murphy Brown and having a baby while dismissing the importance of fathers had been removed from the speech and deleted, and he put it back in. He reinserted it, and, of course, his campaign with George W. Bush was then based on family values, a platform then later embraced by Bill Clinton.
I would assume some of the people who were advertisers on the show were in support of Bush Quayle. Did that affect, did you have anybody canceling their ads?
Things were jogged off track a few times, just in many ways. And from that time, we always had security at the show when we were shooting an episode. We had metal detectors. I mean, I had security who...
Did anybody threaten you? Today, of course, with the internet, you might have...
Open season. Yeah. No, yes, there were threats.
Months after Quayle's speech, Bill Clinton raised the issue in his campaign, and you were on the cover of Time magazine suggesting that Murphy should run for president.
I didn't suggest it, but I was wearing a button that said Murphy Brown for president, so I sort of implied it. You're absolutely right.
And then there was an episode where Murphy is watching Dan Quayle on television talking about her. That was very clever.
Well, that was responding to the whole brouhaha. It was the opening episode for that season after Murphy had the baby, and they played a little clip of Quayle's speech and said, making single mothers glamorous. She's, Frank, am I glamorous? Look at me. And she's in her old pajamas and a T-shirt. That was quite a year.
Candace Bergen is my guest. Her memoir of fine romances published by Simon & Schuster. And that show ran for 10 years. That's a long run.
It was too long. Let me just hasten to say. It was too long.
88 to 98?
Yeah. But, you know, it was the same group of people, the same cast, the same crew, and we loved each other. We loved working together. The money was incredible. And for me, it was very comforting to come back to the structure of that show after my husband had died. I just didn't want to then cast myself adrift right afterwards.
While you were shooting it, Louis Malle became ill, what turned out to be a rare and fatal disease. And were you able to be together more? Like, he died in Beverly Hills, so he...
Yes, he was at home for 10 months of his illness.
You don't flinch from describing the difficulty of caring for a critically ill person in this book. Despite the difficulties, why did you consider yourself relatively lucky?
Well, unlike most people who have to care for a family member who's critically ill, I could afford help. I could afford all the help I needed. And still... You can't escape, and it's very hard on the family and on any member of the household where someone is that ill. It brings up losses that everyone in the household has gone through, you are just going from one day to the next and putting one foot in front of the other. So there's a huge luxury in having help, but finally your life is hijacked.
After he died, did you consider marrying again?
I didn't even date, much less marry. I couldn't even, dating, it was like, ugh.
So how did you meet Marshall Rose?
I was tricked. I was tricked and I didn't find out until the wedding dinner.
So, really?
Yes.
How were you tricked?
That's how naive I was. Marshall and Don Hewitt, who produced 60 Minutes, were friends, and my name came up, and Don said, "Would you like to meet her?" And he said, "Well, sure." And so Don pretended to have a dinner for me because he and I had been talking about my doing something on 60 Minutes. And then two nights before the dinner, he called and said, "Oh, and by the way, a man's going to pick you up before the dinner. His name is Marshall Rose." And so I didn't really think anything about it because he was very shrewd. Mm-hmm. If I had thought that it was a date or a fix-up, I just would have hightailed it away.
Marshall Rose was not in the business.
Not at all.
Was that important?
No.
Because a lot of people don't want to marry people who are in the same business.
And yet...
A lot of shop.
It is a lot of shop, but it's also the same tribe, which is a very nice common thread to have. But no, we're two very different tribes, different shops.
How old was your daughter at the time?
When we were married, she was 14.
Was that a consideration about whether you get married again?
Well, it was a very big consideration because we moved to New York. And that was asking a lot of her.
Did you have to bring him up to speed on popular culture?
Yeah.
And you were of different religions?
Yes. He's Jewish, and I'm a free-floating Gentile. And yes, I did. He'd never watched Seinfeld, for example. He didn't know. I said, "Marshall, let's just have a little tutorial. We're going to put you in touch with the cultural touchstones." And so... Now, of course, he's more aware than I am.
Did Louis Malle watch shows? The equivalent of Seinfeld?
Louis liked to know what was going on everywhere. He was always prowling, and he was just always hungry for knowledge.
You've been married for 15 years.
Yeah.
A very different marriage, I assume, from the one you have with Louis.
Yeah.
You write that there's a hierarchy in acting. Theater is greater than film. Film is greater than TV, and you've worked in all of them with so many outstanding TV series. Do you think that hierarchy has changed?
Yeah. I think that it doesn't get better than great television. Great television is as good as it gets, and I think for a long time, far better than 99% of all movies in intelligence, in ambition, in boldness in what it chooses to deal with. It is just outstanding.
Well, people are talking about
us. When you know the constraints of time, which are ridiculous, the fact that they turn out such incredible levels of product is just dazzling.
People are calling this a golden age, and that's probably partly because cable has raised the stakes.
Yeah.
Now the networks are having to live up to some of the standards that cable gave them. You were in another hit series, Boston Legal, with James Spader and William Shatner. So that must have been a bit of a relief. You didn't have to be in every scene.
No, but our television is a very different kettle of fish than Half Hour. It is an almost inhumane schedule for the crew and the cast. 18-hour days, I mean, it's really almost not even possible.
So nowadays you're doing guest appearances? You're going to be in Battle Creek?
Yeah, that was a great show to do. Very smart, very funny show. Those two guys are great.
And that's a show that's created by Vince Gilligan, who wrote Breaking
and
Bad.
David Shore, by the man who created Breaking Bad,
yeah,
and the man who created House.
Wife.
So it has a very smart DNA.
Your daughter is getting married this summer in her father's chateau in France.
Yes, she is.
Are you involved in the planning?
I am. We were there in February. We were meeting with caterers and redoing the barn. And
did you always intend to write a second memoir?
No,
at all. This one, supposedly, you procrastinated for years.
Well, I procrastinated for years after I told Simon & Schuster that I would turn it in after a year. But it took four, and finally it took a phone call saying, hello. I never did intend to write a second one.
Do you enjoy the act of writing?
I sometimes do, but most of the time I don't.
So you won't continue, you won't be a third memoir, I assume?
I don't even think there's time for that.
But what about a novel or a book about other kinds of experiences? You have such an insider's knowledge of what goes on in theater, film, and TV.
You know, Leonard, I haven't gotten that far. I'm just hoping to survive the book tour.
You're realistic and self-deprecating about the aging process. And that's gotten some reactions.
Yes, a touch too realistic, some might say. Yes, well, aging, I mean, it's not for the faint of heart, let's be frank.
Well, you're aging well, so that helps. And the book's getting wonderful response, so that has to always please you.
It's been very nice, yes.
And it is called A Fine Romance. It is published by Simon & Schuster, and it has been, as always, a great pleasure to have Candice Bergen on the show today. Asif Manvi may be best known as The Daily Show's senior Muslim correspondent, but he's also a prolific actor, producer, screenwriter, playwright, one-time guest host on this show. He starred in the Lincoln Center production of Ayad Akhtar's Pulitzer Prize-winning drama Disgraced in 2012 and wrote Sakina's Restaurant, his one-man show. And he also has written a memoir, No Land's Man, and co-stars and serves as a writer-producer on The Brink, an upcoming comedy show on HBO. But today he's here to discuss his new web series, Halal in the Family, where he stars as Asif Cosby, spelled Q-U apostrophe O-S-B-Y, a stereotypical sitcom dad who also happens to be Muslim. It premieres today at funnyordie.com. And tonight's screening at the Green Space is sold out, but I'm pleased that Asif could join me once again in the studio to talk about it. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you, Leonard.
Why did you decide to parody American perceptions of Islam with, of all things, a campy 80s-style sitcom?
Well, why not? I mean, you know.
I love the name, Halal in the Family.
It's a great name, isn't it? I mean, it was begging to be done, you know. I felt like what had happened was in 2010 or 11, something like that, we did a thing on The Daily Show, which was inspired by something Katie Couric had said, which is that maybe what American Muslims needed was their own Cosby show, you know, to change racial sort of, you know, stereotypes, et cetera. And so we took that to its sort of extreme, illogical place and created a parody sitcom that we aired on The Daily Show.
As The Cosby Show.
It was called The Cosby Show. Yeah, the you know, the Q-U apostrophe O-S-B-Y. And then...
Well, we want to play a clip from it.
Oh, good.
In this scene, you see your son's report card and find that he's failing algebra.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Mr. Wright.
Hey, guys. Well, I just brought your mail for you.
Oh, thanks.
Let's see. Bill, FBI summons?
What?
Just kidding. I mean, you're a true American patriot. Let's see. Bill. Oh. What's this? Something from the local high school.
Oh. Uh-oh. Hold it right there, Tommy. Let's see now. Oh. You got a D in algebra? Now, why would you do that?
Oh, don't blow up at him again.
Why would you say that? Blow up? I would never do anything like that. That's just a very strange way to put things. Am I right?
Playing with all of the language of the time. It would even be more relevant today.
I think it is more relevant today. And actually, you know, subsequently, since that episode aired on The Daily Show, I was approached by my producer of the series and my manager, Lillian LaSalle, and a company called Moore & Associates about putting together something that I wanted to do in the space of dealing with Islamophobia or anti-Muslim bias, etc. And so what we did was I went to Miles Kahn, who had produced the show on The Daily Show originally, and said, hey, do you want to dust off that old sitcom thing that we created, that parody, and use it to address, you know, racism, bigotry, and certain issues that American Muslims deal with today. So what we created were 4 5-minute episodes that you said earlier premiere on Funny or Die today. And they are all dealing with, you know, they're funny, and they use that sitcom parody and format, but they deal with issues that American Muslims deal with all the time.
Could you have done this on Comedy Central or somewhere else?
Maybe. You know, we didn't want to go through the whole sort of machinations of TV executives and all that stuff. We wanted to put something up relatively fast. And we didn't know, honestly, when we put this up, I didn't realize it was going to get the kind of attention that it's getting. And so we made this really relatively cheap. And like I said, there...
Well, you raised money on Indiegogo.
Yeah, we got money from various organizations, including Ford Foundation and other places. And we also raised about $35,000 on Indiegogo. And the truth is that, like, that money came... within a week. Like, it was the appetite for this kind of show, whether it's on television or the web or whatever, was so great that people were just really excited when we told people that we're doing this show and it's, you know, dealing with issues but also funny and portraying an all-American Muslim family. The people started opening up their pocketbooks.
But it's obvious that you also want people to understand this on a serious level. In the crowdfunding video, you talk about an organized network of hate that stokes fear and spreads lies. And in the series, you joke about President Obama being that Muslim guy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Why do you think lies like that harmful Muslim stereotypes are so common?
Well, I think that what's happened since 9/11 is, after 9/11, I felt like Americans were asking... why? You know, they were saying, what happened? Why did this happen to us? And who are these strange Muslims out there, you know? And now, 15 years later, I feel like that conversation has been hijacked by politicians, by much of the media, and the answer has been given back to Americans, and the answer is, you need to be afraid. That's become the... And, you know, so we are now... in a place where the word Muslim, for many Americans, when they hear the word Muslim, it's like hearing the word cancer, you know? We have a 27% approval rating for Muslims, which is just a little bit higher than Congress.
Well, it's often portrayed as the intolerant religion.
Right, exactly. And this is what I mean. It's the entire...
When the president pointed out that other religions have also been intolerant in the past...
Of course.
People came down on him real hard.
I know. And this is the problem, that you can't have a nuanced conversation about this. You can't have a, you know, you end up with these big brushstrokes, sort of general statements about, you know, a billion people or, you know, as if all Muslims are the same. And, you know, and this, the politics of the Middle East is complicated. The Muslim world itself is complicated and nuanced, and these conversations are complicated, and that's what people don't want to really deal with.
I guess it's just the horrific side of beheadings and things like that, destroying historic sites, that has made this seem worse than others, although killing people is killing people.
Mm-hmm.
Early in your career, you played a lot of stereotypically Muslim characters, including a cab driver in the third Die Hard movie. Have you ever been offered a movie role that didn't require to play a stereotypical character?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I did a movie called Million Dollar Arm recently, which was a terrific film starring John Hamm. I played a sports agent. And, you know, I think it's changed over the last, you know, several years because people know who I am now and, you know.
Well, here you're playing a different kind of stereotypical character, mm-hmm. right? Sweater-wearing Cliff Huxtable.
Right. Well,
type.
Here I'm parodying the all-American dad, right? So it's, mm-hmm. you know, which is like, he's kind of a combination of Bill Cosby, Al Bundy, you know, Archie Bunker, you know, that kind of character. So what we're doing here is using the tropes of an American sitcom, all of the familiar things that we know about an American sitcom, but we're inserting a Muslim family into that.
Although the type of two-camera laugh track sitcom like The Cosby Show isn't done much anymore.
No.
In one of the can I place another
sure.
thing from one of the new episodes?
Yeah, sure.
Your Muslim Cosbys enter a Halloween house decorating contest so that they can win a gift certificate to the Cheesecake Factory. But they run into trouble when people see their theme. Here's that clip.
There's a crowd of people outside protesting.
Oh, they're really scared.
They're protesting because they think this is a new mosque that's opened up.
A mosque? Why would I build a mosque? I'm not trying to cause any trouble. This is just a harmless, haunted terrorist training camp. Why don't people see this?
I don't know. Maybe it's because they watch a lot of that show, Homeland.
This doesn't even look like a mosque. These people have no imagination.
Oh, I think they have plenty of imagination, which is why you need to change this house back to normal so that we can show them that we're a normal family and that mosques aren't haunted terrorist training camps.
Okay, so you're saying I shouldn't put on my zombie Bin Laden costume?
Okay, fine, it's a bad idea.
I assume that came out of the big furor over the Ground Zero mosque.
Yeah, that and many other protests around mosques around
mosque.
The country. No, they didn't. You know, and you know, that was one particular episode where I really wanted to sort of focus on this idea of the mosque protests, and you know, and my character. Decides to create this haunted house, and he decides to create the thing that would frighten Americans the most, which is a haunted terrorist training camp, and instead people think it's a mosque, you know? And so that's the satirical part of it.
In talking to the people who did Everybody Loves Raymond, they said that they drew a lot of the humor from their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do that here as well?
Not as much from my own life personally. You know, this is a satire of the idea of a sitcom. We drew a lot of the humor from the tropes of sitcom format, you know, and tried to insert that into there. But you know, look, All in the Family was one of the inspirations for this, and they dealt with a lot of social and political issues of their time through humor. And actually, Norman Lear was one of the people that gave us some money. In the crowdfunding to help get this up.
Is it important to have messages when you're doing humor?
It doesn't. I don't think it's. I mean, no, not necessarily.
But much of your humor has been along those lines, partly because of The Daily Show, which gets humor out of it finds funny things in real life situations.
Yeah, well, I mean, with The Daily Show, we use satire to, you know, we use the news, the real news, as our raw material, and so I like talking about issues, and you know, for me, my humor is often related to issues that I'm passionate about. Yeah.
In addition to the web series Halal in the Family TV features resources devoted to combating a number of issues like mm-hmm. Islamophobia, unwanted surveillance, bullying, and more. Tell me about those efforts.
Well, there's, you know, we worked with various organizations who are dealing, you know, advocacy groups and legal organizations that are dealing with these issues in the real world, you know, in courts and things. And so they gave us a lot of the information in terms of the issues that we even wanted to deal with on the show. And so if you go to halalinthefamily.tv, There are, you know, you can click on the thing and it'll tell you what you can do and the resources that are available to deal with some of these issues if you want to get involved more.
Much of the news these days involves the problems of black people just having mm-hmm. to deal with everyday life. Mm-hmm. Have these things also affected the average Muslim family in America?
I think it's slightly different, but, you know, look, racism and bigotry, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, they all come from, you know, the same root cause. And you know, a lot of it has to do with fear, misinformation, you know. And so I think whether you're, even if you're dealing with a series that particularly maybe points out Islamophobia, it's the same about anti-Semitism or racism.
As we heard this morning on the news, where a Republican candidate for higher office in Missouri, I don't know if you know the story, but they started spreading rumors that he was Jewish, as though that would somehow explain why he shouldn't be voted for.
Well, you know, there's only one Jewish Republican congressperson, and so, you know... clearly, the Republicans love Israel, but not Jews so much.
Your guest stars in this show, or we're not calling it shows. These are little. How long are they?
Well, they're 5-minute episodes. They're sort of, you know, bite-sized episodes, I guess.
But you get some pretty good people here: Sakina Jaffrey from House of Cards, mm-hmm. Samantha Bee, and Jordan Klepper. You work with them on The Daily Show.
Yeah.
Also, Tariq Black Thought Trotter from The Roots. Do they play themselves?
No, they play characters on the show and on the episodes. And, you know, they all donated their time and were really excited to be part of this. You know, most of the people that got involved in this on the as actors or even behind the scenes donated their time and their efforts towards this because I think they thought it was well worth it and a funny and a great cause.
We don't have much time, but can you tell us a bit about your upcoming HBO series?
Yeah, it's called The Brink. It's coming out on June 21st on HBO, and it's a geopolitical comedic satire dealing with one geopolitical crisis seen through three departments of U.S. government over the course of 10 episodes, and it stars Jack Black, Tim Robbins, Pablo Schreiber, Carla Gugino, John Larroquette, myself. It's great. It's going to be very funny and a very dark comedy that I don't think we've seen in a long time. It's sort of like if it's kind of in the vein of Dr. Strangelove or MASH or something like that. It's kind of like if Homeland or 24 was a comedy. That would be The Brink.
If Homeland was a comedy. Well, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, are you going to continue on The Daily Show after Trevor Noah takes over?
I have no plans to go anywhere right now. I mean, I've been sort of working on The Daily Show part-time this last year anyway.
You've
because,
been cutting back on it.
Yeah, well, I've been doing The Brink and other projects like Halal and the Family and things. So I've been sort of part-time on The Daily Show, so I'll probably continue doing that.
And meanwhile, you have this your acting career. Mm-hmm. Are you going to do the one-man show anymore?
I don't have any plans to right now. I would love to do another one-person show, so that would be something. Yeah, definitely, I'd like to do that.
And then tonight you will be speaking at the Green Space, mm-hmm. and although the tickets are sold, they will be screening Halal in the Family. But people can see it as a webcast.
Yeah, you can see it as
right now you have a strong presence on the web, don't you?
I really do. And, you know, it's been...
I'm going to have to say from now on, Asif Manvi, stage screen, and the web.
And the intern webs, yeah. No, look, the response has been terrific. Halal and the Family has, I mean, just the support and the response and people talking about it and wanting to discuss these issues has been beyond my expectation of even when we created it. So I'm really pleased, yeah.
Well, since you're so busy, should we forget asking you to come back as a guest host?
I'll always come back. You know, I it was great. I mean, I got thrown into it and it was terrific. And it was like, you know, now I've done it once. So I'll definitely come back. Yeah.
It does feel dangerous to do anything that you've never done before.
It does, yeah.
But
it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
Remind people that they can see you tonight at the Green Space event.
Yes.
And will you be playing all of the segments?
I don't know what we'll be playing. Probably not all of them. Maybe just a couple of them we'll show to the audience. You know, want to leave some mystery for them to go and check it out on the web as well.
And they'll be able to find it at?
It's on funnyordie.com, and it's also on halalinthefamily.tv.
And as I said, you can access what's going on at the Green Space tonight. We will be streaming it live, starting at, I think, 7:15.
7:15, yeah.
And we could be bringing anyone else there?
It'll be myself. The producers will be there. Miles Kahn, who is the director and one of the producers. And so we'll all be there, yeah. So, and maybe some of the cast might be there as well.
And you could do this thing on a real shoestring. You got something like $38,000?
Well, we got more than that, actually, but it wasn't a lot of money. And, you know, we did this really quite cheap. And well, the hope is that if we get enough attention and sort of response from people, that we can do more of them in the future.
And a reminder that Asif Manvi's memoir, No Land's Man, is still in print.
It is.
You can find it at your local bookstore.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks a lot, Leonard. Thanks for having me back.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Helen McDonald was finishing a postgraduate degree at Cambridge University when her father died unexpectedly, plunging her into a profound state of mourning. To deal with her grief, Ms. McDonald took a step I'd guess few of us would consider. She bought a 10-week-old goshawk, named it Mabel, and set out to train and tame this notoriously vicious and temperamental bird of prey. She has written about it in H is for Hawk, which has been getting rave reviews, including one on the front page of the February 17th Sunday New York Times Book Review. It is published by Grove Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Helen McDonald to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's lovely to be here.
Your book won the Samuel Johnson Prize and the Costa Book Award after it was published in Great Britain last year. And when it was published here, it debuted at number 8 on the New York Times hardcover nonfiction bestseller list last month. I think it's up now to 5, isn't it?
Yes, it's been bewildering and lovely. I didn't expect any of this to happen. It's extraordinary.
Do you see any irony in the fact that a book you wrote about your almost desperate need to separate yourself from the world has brought you so much attention?
This is it. You know, it's part of the job. If you write a book, you know, you have to go around afterwards and meet people, and it's been a surprising delight. You know, I always thought I was an introvert, and particularly this book, as you say, it's about withdrawing from the world and running away from it, and suddenly here I am meeting more people than I've ever done in my life before, and it's been wonderful, yeah.
Your father was a newspaper photographer. How old was he when he died?
He was 67.
So young.
So he was pretty young. He was a very renowned newspaper photographer in Britain. And in the way of such things, you know, we never realized, my brother and I, how renowned he was until after he died. And he was, you know, incredibly well respected. And he died very, very suddenly. He had a heart attack. And I think the suddenness of that death, and anyone who's experienced a sudden death will know, it does something. It kind of tears the world in half. And I got, you know, I was very lost after he died.
How old were you? You had a close relationship.
Yeah, we were good friends. You know, he was one of my best friends, as well as being a very great dad. And I was 37. But I was kind of on my own. I didn't have a partner at the time. I didn't have a job, really. I was an academic. I guess that is a job. I feel really bad saying that now. But, yeah, when he passed away, I got a bit lost, and I'd been a falconer, I'd trained hawks before, and I decided that what I needed to do was train this goshawk to kind of run away from my grief. I don't recommend this, by the way, to the listeners. You know, if you are feeling really miserable or you've suffered a big loss, don't go and buy a goshawk.
You know? I want to back up for a second.
Yeah.
You said you didn't really have a job. You were teaching history and philosophy.
History and philosophy of science, but I didn't have a full-time job. I was a postgraduate, so there was a lot of free time, and it was coming to an end, that job as well, so I was sort of thinking about what to do next, yeah.
You said that you became obsessed with hawks as a young girl. Any idea of why hawks rather than so many other friendlier bird species?
Well, they are really cool, aren't they? I mean, you know,
they're scary.
Well, yeah, I know, but you know, you look at lots of kids get obsessed with things that are slightly scary, you know, dinosaurs and volcanoes and that kind of thing. You know, things that are just scary enough to be able to be mastered when you're a kid. And I just thought they were the most amazing things the world had ever made. They're incredibly beautiful.
Did your parents encourage your obsession?
They were incredibly patient. I don't know how they put up with me, to be honest. I used to drag them to zoos and falconry centres, and I used to kind of be clinging to the wire and sort of, you know, it'd be getting dark and I'd be staring at this eagle or something and I'd be like, no, don't take me, you know, I want to stay here. And when I told them I was going to be a falconer when I grew up, you know, there was only a few times where they said things like, are you sure you don't want to be a lawyer, you know. They were very patient with me.
This goes back fairly early into your childhood. You say that as soon as you started to read, you began to study anything you could find out about hawks, including The Goshawk by T.H. White. Now, White is best known, I don't know about England, but in this country, for his books on the legend of King Arthur, including The Sword and the Stone.
Yeah, an amazing
book. Were there hawks in that book?
There are hawks
in that
book.
There's falconry.
Yes, there is falconry. So the young King Arthur is turned into a small falcon by the wizard Merlin. It's an extraordinary scene in The Sword and the Stone. But this book, The Goshawk, he wrote was a very odd book. And I read it, as I say, when I was very, very small. And it's about his attempt, this writer's attempt to train a goshawk in 1936.
Unsuccessfully.
He didn't know what he was doing. And he was a very strange and sad and broken man, really struggling with who he was. And I think his struggle with a goshawk was in some ways a struggle with himself, and it ended in sort of tragedy. And I became quite obsessed with the book when I was small. But I think it taught me that when you're broken, when you feel that life's really hard, what you can do is get a goshawk. And that's what I did.
Now, he felt isolated, partly because he was a closeted homosexual who didn't feel comfortable in society. And like you, he isolated himself with his young goshawk and limited his interaction with other people. But is that a common method for training a bird of prey? Do you have to isolate yourself?
You do initially. So although in all the birds of prey used in falconry in the United Kingdom are all captive bred, they're all bred in aviaries, they're still totally wild when you pick them up. And you have to persuade them that humans aren't monstrous. So, you know, people often think that birds of prey are these ferocious, horrible things that are sort of trying to get you all the time. But actually, they're terrified, and you have to persuade them you're a good thing. And you do that through gifts of food. So you kind of just sort of limit the amount of human life the hawk sees initially by locking yourself away for a week or so inside your house.
It's best, well, it's only
best
one
for
person.
The hawk. Yeah, it's best really that way.
You almost describe them as being paranoid.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, one of the themes of the book is that we use nature as a mirror of ourselves. And I think, you know, there are all these people that say that goshawks are paranoid and psychopathic and murderous and fierce. But actually, you know, I was surprised with my goshawk, how unbelievably friendly and tame she was. In the end, you know, I ended up playing with her. I'd throw her paper balls and I'd scrunch it into little balls and she'd catch them in her beak and throw them back to me. You know, very kitten-like behavior.
Still, I'm surprised that White's story didn't turn you off falconing altogether, because it turned out so badly.
Yeah.
Can the troubles he had training his bird be blamed on his lack of skill, or are goshawks a little more unpredictable?
Oh,
He had one that wasn't as nice as your
Mabel. Yeah, no, he was unlucky with his hawk. But there's a lot of things, I think, that went into that. Partly he didn't have the knowledge, he didn't have the skill, he didn't have the information to be able to train a hawk properly.
And you were already a trained
falconer at
Mabel.
The time, exactly. But partly also I just think because he had a very unlucky childhood with horrendous parents and schooling, he didn't really know how to care for things. He didn't know how to look after things and love them. And I think that was the deepest problem there with him and his hawk.
My guess is Helen MacDonald, her book, H is for Hawk. By the time you purchased Mabel, you had, as I said, been an experienced falconer, mostly with breeds similar to goshawks. Goshawk, it's shortened for goosehawk, isn't it?
Yeah, it comes from goosehawk because they're such, you know, brute and powerful birds. They can even catch geese. The females can catch geese. It's a very old word. But I mainly flew other kinds of birds. I mainly flew falcons, which are very different. I mean, there are peregrine falcons all over New York now. You know, they're very aerial. They're very fast. They fly in the upper air with these long pointed wings. Whereas goshawks are much less like falcons, and they're more like kind of helicopter gunships. They're low level attack merchants, you know, and they're pretty powerful. They use sort of strength and brute force to kill rather than speed.
Their nervous systems are jacked up and they react to stimuli automatically without thinking.
Yeah, they're very odd birds to interact with because they live life so much faster than we do. that often they'll jump or they'll be scared at something before you even notice it. Yeah.
So did you choose the goshawk because of the challenges it presented?
Partly, I think. Partly I knew that it would be a huge distraction. This bird that is legendarily difficult to train and tame would be a greater distraction than something that was maybe a dog or a cat or something. It would be a real way of disappearing, basically.
And most people, when they are going through a grieving period and they look to an animal to add something to their life, they're going to pick a dog or a cat.
This is true. Partly I didn't, because I'm horribly allergic to mammals. They make me sneeze. But mostly it was because I wanted to be that hawk. I wanted to be all the things the hawk was to me. I wanted the hawk, you know, she was solitary, she was self-possessed, she was ferocious, she was full of rage, she didn't have any kind of grief or human emotion. And the longer I spent with that hawk, the more I felt that I was more like a hawk than a person. And it sounds really overblown now, but it really was a sort of sense that I was disappearing from who I was.
How long did it take to convince Mabel that you weren't her enemy?
Well, that didn't take too long, actually. It only took a few days, really. What took longer to convince her of was that other people weren't frightening. And I had to take her outside and walk her around the streets of Cambridge. And anyone who's been to Cambridge in England knows it's a pretty eccentric place, but there are limits.
You know, did you have her chained to your
arm? Yeah, I was holding on to her. There are leather straps called jesses around their legs, and I was holding on to those, and she was sort of picking away a bit of food. And I'd show her kind of, you know, buses and bicycles and buggies, and she was very frightened of dogs, big dogs. She was fascinated with small dogs. I think that was for other reasons. But yeah, that was a very weird experience walking around the town with her.
Why did you name her Mabel? It just seems so un-goshawk-like.
It does. There's a falconer's tradition that if you call a hawk something terrifying and monstrous, it will just sit on a fence post and squeak at you. But if you give a bird like a goshawk a very cute name, it will often be a very proficient hunter. So I have a friend who has a goshawk called Bunty, and another one who has a goshawk called Baby Doll. So this is quite. But also the word Mabel is from the Latin amabilis, meaning lovable. And I think even though I was trying to run away from everything with this hawk, part of me still wanted to be loved, and that was why I called her Mabel too.
But the tradition has it, if you give the hawk a nice name, it's going to be vicious. And yeah. If you give it a nasty name, it's going to turn out to be too.
Well, you know, falconry tradition is a bit like military tradition. There's all sorts of backwards and weird things that go on in falconry that have been like that for thousands of years.
You've said that you learned patience from your father.
Yes.
That probably came in handy in working with Mabel.
Yes.
You've written that you try to make yourself invisible.
Yeah, so it's a very strange sort of psychological experience when you first sit with a hawk. You've got a piece of meat in your, of raw steak in your gloved left fist, and the hawk is sitting on top of it, basically. And you have to pretend with all your heart that you're not there, because you want the meat to be the only thing in the room that the hawk notices. It's a very weird feeling. You kind of sort of imaginatively just sort of disappear from the room.
Is that like meditating?
Yeah, it's kind of like meditating. It's kind of like taking yourself to a different place where the hawk can't see you. And again, it sounds a very odd thing to say, but when you're doing it, it's, you know, all falconers I know do this. It's a way of disappearing.
Didn't T.H. White have trouble with his hawk because he overfed it and had less patience than he probably
he wanted to fight his hawk. He wasn't a very patient man, and he didn't really understand either. There's something that's part of falconry, and that is that hawks, initially, you train them through their stomachs, basically. You know, this word fed up, this lovely word fed up, I'm feeling fed up when you don't want to do anything, comes from falconry. It's when a hawk's got a huge tummy full of food and it doesn't want to fly. And I think T.H. White wanted the hawk to love him, and he just fed it and fed it and fed it and fed it. And eventually the hawk was like, I don't want any more food. I just want to sleep, you know. And it was this awful battle that they had, yeah.
People train hawks, falcons, for hunting.
Mm.
Did you take Mabel out hunting?
I did, and that wasn't the reason I wanted the hawk. The reason was complicated and to do with me, as I say, running away from grief. But I knew that if I had a hawk, that she would be hunting. And I think that's what goshawks are made of. They're very predatory birds. And I think having one and not letting it do that would be like having a kid and saying, you can't play. You know, that's what they're made of.
You ended up taking many of the animals she'd caught from her and breaking their necks to put them out of their misery so she wouldn't eat them alive.
Yeah.
Obviously, owning a hawk is not for the squeamish.
Well, I'm not squeamish, but I'm pretty sentimental. I'm famously, you know, I hate killing flies and spiders. You know, I'm not a bloodthirsty sort of woman, but there was the great irony was that I was trying to avoid to escape the reality of death, and there I was having to kill things every day with the hawk, and it was a very instructive and sobering experience.
You say that hunting with the hawk took you to the very edge of being human.
Mm. Yeah, just running around with her in the fields, watching her fly. The landscape became something very, very different and rich and strange. It was a... I guess the whole phenomenon of the landscape altered for me. But then when, you know, when she caught things, that was a very different moment. I felt very human, very accountable and very responsible in a way I guess I never had before.
And then, of course, she caught, as you said,
yeah.
Things like you crumpled up an empty cardboard tube and threw it. You played with it as though it were a ball.
Mm.
There are some comic moments here, such as when you pursued Mabel to the garden of a grand home and were shouted at from a window by a woman dressed in a recreational maid's outfit.
Well, I reckon so, you know, because this was kind of, I went.
She was engaged in role playing.
I suspect so. You know, at the time I thought, oh look, I'm in the 1920s, but looking back on it, I suspect, you know, that there was something else going on there. And you know, one of the great things about being in America is also that I know I won't be found by any of the landowners. That my hawk poached a lot of pheasants inadvertently, I hasten to add, over the months I flew her. And you know, thank goodness I'm not going to be found out by anyone here. I think I
don't want to give away too much, so I'll just say you eventually realized that as much as you love living with your hawk, you needed to renew your connections to the world. But then you write a book. A book can be a very lonely process as well.
It's pretty lonely writing a book. There's a lot of swearing and eating of pizza and self-doubt. And I didn't think the book was a kind of way of coming to terms with what happened. I just felt that it needed to be written. And then when I finished the book, there was a sudden realization that it was over. It was a way of saying goodbye to my father properly and of saying goodbye to the person I was back then.
It's a fascinating story, but the reason the book has gotten such a response is also because you've written it so beautifully. Had you always wanted to write?
Yes, I wrote poetry before I wrote prose. And I've always in my life sort of swung between the two kind of poles of birds and falconry and nature and literature and history. And I think this is the first time with this book that all that those two parts of me have both come into play and been used at the same time. And that's a really nice feeling for me.
I noticed before the final NCAA basketball game, a falconer released a bald eagle that flew a circle around the arena as a band played the national anthem. How difficult would it be to train an eagle to fly around in a noisy and chaotic basketball arena?
Oh, eagles compared to goshawks are pretty chilled out, actually. You know, they're big and lumbering and very beautiful, but they're not quite as temperamental. So that would be easier than a goshawk to train.
I once witnessed on San Juan Island in outside of Seattle an event that occurs every day. A man brings the chicken that has passed its expiration date out to a certain crossroads. The eagles know that he's going to be there every day at 4 o'clock.
Oh, that's fantastic.
He tosses the meat into a field.
Mm-hmm.
The eagles come swooping down, grab a piece of meat, and then go off. And they only take one. So the ravens that have been waiting patiently for the eagles to do what they've done then come in and take the rest of the meat.
Wow, that's marvelous. There you go. See, we can live in harmony with the natural world. That's a great story.
You couldn't have gotten a goshawk to go around that arena.
I think it would have been a tricky job with a goshawk, yes. They're such spooky and strange and alien birds that I think you'd be best sticking with an eagle.
The Economist has called Helen MacDonald's book, H is for Hawk, one part memoir, one part gorgeous evocation of the natural world, and one part literary meditation. It's published in this country by Grove Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Caitlin O'Connell has spent decades in Etosha National Park in Namibia studying the behavior and communication of African male elephants. And what she's found is a society that mixes loyalty and organization with bullying and violence. Her new book, Elephant Dawn, The Politics of a Pachyderm Posse, reveals the surprisingly complex and eerily familiar world of elephants. Ms. O'Connell is a faculty member at Stanford University School of Medicine. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, Boston Globe, the National Geographic, among others. And this book is published by University of Chicago Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Caitlin O'Connell back to our show. Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much.
Wasn't very little known about the social world of male elephants until fairly recently. Why has the research been so limited?
Well, I think so much is happening within family groups that you tend to focus on that, and because the next generation is being raised and there are a lot of fascinating things going on with females, that I think the focus was on family groups.
Are elephants a male-dominated society?
No, they're very much a female-dominated society. It's a matriarchal society, but when males are between 12 and 15 years of age, they get kicked out. They sort of choose somewhat to leave, but they really get forced out of the family, and then they make their own society as adults.
Which has a strict hierarchy.
Yes, a very strict hierarchy, and so do the females.
How do elephants move up and down their hierarchies?
Well, that's an interesting question. We always wondered whether it's more stressful to be on top of the hierarchy or more stressful to be on the bottom. And we had some very dry years and very wet years, so we could watch the manipulation of this hierarchy through the effect of climate change.
And at the watering holes.
At the watering hole, yes. So if you have very little water, the idea of why dominance hierarchies form is to minimize conflict over access to resources, and in this case it would be water. And so these hierarchies are very strict in dry years so that they're not fighting for water. But in wet years, the hierarchy kind of breaks down and it becomes more circular, and elephants can drink wherever they want, so they don't have to, say, kowtow to the don for a drink. They can just go wherever. And so you don't have as strict as a hierarchy in that situation.
Does a hierarchy play a role in relations between males and females? Because in chimpanzees, for example, the dominant male always has first dibs at the female in estrus.
Yes, and that is a very critical thing that happens in elephants. The males do something that's similar to rutting an antelope, except for antelope go into this hormonal state, high testosterone state, all at the same time, and they fight for females. But in elephants, it's very unique. They have a turn-taking system where only one male is in must at any one time, and you can have a dominance hierarchy between must males, but they're it's almost like a gentlemanly, okay, this guy's in must and he's so aggressive, we're just going to leave him alone so he gets to mate.
You open the book with a day when your elephant Don, and we'll get to why you call him a Don, was very agitated because he was in must?
No, his the third ranking bull was in must, and you know, this guy is really fit. And for all
Kevin
that,
was the one that
Kevin
was
in must. And for all that's been previously published, you would expect that Kevin would just march right over Greg and become the dominant bull. But what happened really surprised us and launched this 10-year study. The dominant bull beat the must bull and a high-ranking must bull, and that just isn't what's supposed to happen.
They had a fight.
They had a fight, and Kevin lost. He backed up and left the clearing without maintaining his dominance over the waterhole.
Kevin and Greg aren't Namibian names. Who names them? You?
Well, we have a different naming strategy and usually related to some kind of physical character, physical feature. Greg actually was the former elephant keeper at the Oakland Zoo, and we had a lot of volunteers from the Oakland Zoo at the time, so the dominant bull was picked as that name.
Now, when they have a fight, how damaging can it be? How violent can it be? Do either of them get really hurt? They have these sharp tusks.
Yes, they can fight to the death, and you know, I've seen rhinos do it, and elephants. It's one of the reasons when you see them fighting, they square up. They never want to show their flank, because that tusk can go right through and puncture the lung. So it's a very, very dangerous situation.
Can you spot who the dominant bull is? Could you spot that Greg was a dominant bull simply by the way he acted?
Yes, right from the beginning, you can, you know, there's a lot of body language that goes on, and a more dominant, confident bull would have their head straight up and their shoulders up. And as they walk towards the waterhole, you can see who thinks they're dominant. But by the time they get to the waterhole, it's how everyone else treats that individual that lets you know that they're dominant. And that is they back away from the prime spot. They wait for the dominant bull to stand at the prime spot, and then they'll come. And it's, to me, it seems like kissing of the ring of a mafioso don, where they just come each one by one. And with a little trepidation, they'll touch their trunk into the mouth of the dominant bull, and that's a sign of reverence, a greeting, a sign of if I'm a dominant individual, I'm not going to cause any trouble. There's a lot of ritual.
I won't hurt you.
I won't hurt you, yes. I won't challenge you.
My guest is Caitlin O'Connell, whose latest book is Elephant Don, The Politics of a Pachyderm Posse. You write that on your expeditions you have a homemade elephant dung dryer. How did you make it? They don't sell it? GE doesn't make an elephant dung dryer?
Well, you know, over the years we don't have that many resources, and we needed it to be a solar dryer because the whole camp is run off of solar energy. So we took computer fans and put them into a toolbox and had different shelves on the toolbox, inside the toolbox with gratings, and it just works really well.
How does it work?
You turn it on. It runs off of a 12-volt battery, and the fans suck moisture out of the toolbox over 24 hours, and then you have each individual's dung on a shelf, and then you take it out, and it's all dry, and you sift it, and then you extract hormones from the...
And what kind of information can you collect from elephant dung? I'm assuming you collected both Greg and Kevin's dung.
Yes, and from that particular situation. So you, the hormones will affect the dung, will come out in the dung 24 hours after that particular behavior. So we saw Greg's testosterone level shoot up just in that moment, that day, and then drop right back down. And then Kevin's testosterone had been high, and his
dropped. That's because he was in must.
He was in must, and his level dropped off and stayed down. So, effectively, Greg suppressed him from continuing his must period.
You write that in 1992, during a nine-month vacation, your career made an unexpected turn. That's what got you into this?
Yes. My boyfriend, now husband, and I took a nine-month break between degrees, and we traveled through southern Africa. I was an entomologist at the time and wanted to go to Namibia to see the desert beetles. And one thing
led to... A lot smaller than elephants.
A lot smaller, yes. One thing led to another, and they were looking for researchers to study elephants, and they didn't have someone, and I had a master's. And at the time, I had all the right tools, and my husband was very technologically oriented, and so they offered us this job.
How long do you need to observe an elephant to understand his or her personality, and what is normal behavior?
Well, what is normal is a tricky question, because elephants are very much like humans. You day to day have a certain personality, certain character. And that can change based on other pressures, based
they
on social
moody?
Pressures. Yes, they
do
can
do they
get...
lie?
Well, I've seen dishonest, what's called dishonest signaling in elephants, where a must bull would express all of the characteristics of a must bull, waving their ears and trunk curling, and then have very low testosterone. So in nature, that means there's a cheating going on, that they don't have to expend all that energy of must, but they can still intimidate other bulls. Mm-hmm. And we've seen this in several different characters, and it's very similar to dishonest signaling in other species, and including humans.
I get the feeling that you saw lots of similarities between elephant behavior and human behavior.
Many similarities, from the ritualized greetings to the fighting to the very subtle politics between a highest ranking bull and, you know, stopping a mid ranking bull from being aggressive towards one of his close associates. He would actually go in and intervene in a fight.
Is there a nature versus nurture debate about elephant behavior as there is about human behavior?
There is, and I think that, well, we're starting to really focus on this issue of if you are born of a dominant female, what is your life experience and how would you be as an adult? Would you be a benevolent dictator or would you be a very subordinate individual? And we're just starting that timeline now. And so far we're seeing with calves of dominant individuals that they have a little more leeway and they're more social. So it makes you wonder if there's royalty in elephants versus, you know, the prevailing thought is that there's the next matriarch is the next oldest, wisest, not the daughter of the matriarch. But in our situation, in a desert environment, maybe we have a different culture going on, but it does seem like the matriarch has her line of preferred individuals.
But the fathers don't take much of a role in caring for the children?
No, definitely
not. Because they're going off on their own.
Yes.
They probably wouldn't even know who their children are.
Well, we're seeing evidence that they may actually be able to smell their relatives, just like mice do. Many species do this to protect from inbreeding. And in elephants, we suspected that these groups of males, these bonded groups of males, might have some relationship, because what would the benefit be of having to share your resources with these younger males? So we did a small study on looking at MHC compatibility, which is major histocompatibility complex, and there's genes attached to that scent that we have it as well. And it looks as though they actually are selecting each other based on relatives versus not.
They must notice that you're around. Do they accept you?
We really try and keep our distance. I mean, every June, July when we're there, they can smell us, they can see vehicles and activity. But I think they know that we don't cause them any problems and we respect them and keep our distance. So they're not bothered by us.
You mentioned males fighting. Does this begin in adolescence? Because adolescent human boys, of course, often bully each other and fight with each other.
It's very similar. In fact, this coming of age between 12 and 15, they're constantly sparring and testing out their strength. And then when they leave the family, they've got to figure out who's going to be their comrades for the rest of their lives. Are they going to have this kind of fission-fusion like the females do? They seem to have close bonds with a few individuals. And then with Greg's group, there's almost between 12 and 15 individuals, and it really seems character-driven. He's such a good solicitor, and he brings the next generation in. He, you know, stops fights from happening, and it's just very unusual.
So there it is. The guys get together.
The guys do. They hang out in what we call a boys' club.
And then when they come in contact with the females, that's as kind of outsiders?
You know, when it's so funny. There's kind of a passing of ships. When the males will hang out at the waterhole from 12 until 4-ish during the day, and then the females start to come in. And when they do, the males sort of think, oh, gosh, there's all this politics. We're going to leave now. They tend to leave as the females arrive, unless there's a male in must or there's a young male who wants to interact with that family because he knows some of the younger males and he'll want to spar with them. But usually they just leave, unless the must bull is there, and then he'll stay and check all of the females and see who's in estrus, if any.
Caitlin O'Connell will be giving a talk tonight at 6 o'clock at the Explorers Club on East 70th Street. For more information about that and to get tickets, you can go to our show page here at WNYC.org. She's a faculty member at Stanford University School of Medicine, author of the science memoir The Elephant's Secret Sense, and now of Elephant Dawn, The Politics of a Pachyderm Posse. It is published by the University of Chicago Press. It's been a pleasure having you on our show again.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate being here.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.